Hello, everybody. This is my first time hosting the show alone, so hopefully this is going to go okay. This is Ilana Levin with Blog Talk Radio show Graphic Policy Radio. We are the podcast for comics and politics, and today we have a slightly different episode. We are covering a topic that is near and dear to the hearts of many geeks, but is not actually about comic books itself. We're going to be talking about the Game of Thrones TV show, a bit about the A Song of Ice and Fire, a book series as part of that, I imagine, and about what's to come on both. And my guest today is none other than Stephen Adewell, who is someone who, when he said he had any interest in doing a podcast with me on the topic of Game of Thrones, I felt humbled and honored, and I don't feel that way a lot. So I want to introduce my co-host for this episode, Stephen Adewell. He's the author of Race for the Iron. Hey, he is the author of Race for the Iron Throne, Volume 1, an ebook that collects essays on the politics and history behind the novels. He has two essays in the forthcoming ebook, Tower of the Hand, A Hand of Spring, which you should definitely be buying. I read the earlier one, Tower of the Hand book, and it was awesome, very informative and thoughtful and smart. And then he's also writing the forthcoming book, Analyzing the World of Ice and Fire, King's Hands and City-States, which examines the political structures of Westeros and Essos. He also podcasts about HBO's Game of Thrones for the blog Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and that's how I came to know him, is through his amazing podcast. I think that Stephen knows more about these books than anyone else out there. So we're in for a real treat today, and thank you for joining us. So the impetus for us doing this particular episode is that in their promotion for the new Game of Thrones season 5 coming out, they decided to make a little extra money off the fans by doing an IMAX movie screening in a few select cities where we'd get to see the last two episodes of last season and a special trailer of the new season. And so that's the opportunity that we jumped on to do this show today. So we're coming straight off of having watched the final two episodes of season 4. And having seen this trailer for season 5, which now is available on the Game of Thrones Facebook page. If you go there, you'll be able to watch it. And I'll just also say this is a completely spoiler-filled podcast, because this particular episode is for people who are really geeky about these materials, which means you probably should go read and watch them. So don't say you weren't warned. And hell, we'll assume that you've read the Duncan Egg tales as well, if that is where it even comes up, which it probably wouldn't too extensively. So that's where we sit right now. So, Stephen, did you want to give me some overall thoughts to start with about the experience of watching these shows in IMAX versus having seen them on our home TVs before?
Sure. The first thing I noticed is, especially episode 9, The Watchers on the Walls, which is the big battle sequence at Castle Black, it felt a lot more impressive than it did on my little rinky-dink television. The giants felt gianter, the mammoths felt mammother, and the wall really felt 700 feet tall. And so, it just lands with more did when you're watching it on the small screen. And as a result, I walked away from it feeling a lot more impressed than I did the first time around.
Mm-hmm. You were really able to see the justice of the camera work, the details of the setting. The horns that they're blowing to warn of a wildling attack is engraved. I'm positive I didn't see that when I watched it on my TV.
Yeah. You can catch all kinds of little visual details like that. And the sound, too. I mean, the sound is rattling around you, and it really feels, it makes you feel like you're on the battlefield itself.
That's true.
I was really impressed by, the fact that, you expect movies to look good in IMAX, because they've got, $200 million, budget and so forth. But this is, a TV episode that cost, I know they spent a lot of money on it, but, couldn't have cost more than $10 or $20 million to make. And up there on the big screen, it looks like, what you would expect from a big budget action movie.
Yeah, you cannot tell that it's not done on that kind of a budget. I mean, I'm sure part of the reason why they're able to do it this way is that they really limit the setting of where it's going to be to one place that is real, that we know is not, you know, CGI-y, which is the castle side of the wall. This is a smart way to set that. And they have so many wonderful sweeping shots, continuing shots of all the action that goes through.
Yeah.
Like, you really don't even notice cutting. The camera is just going up and down and with it the whole way through.
My favorite shot is there's this one looping shot that the director, Neil Marshall, who is at this point an expert on how to do battle sequences, on a budget, goes like on one side of the wall all the way up and over to the other side. And you can sort of, you know, see people move from sort of, you know, they transform from sort of normal sized people, you know, down to the size of ants. And then, you know, you see more ants on the other side, and then it zooms down to human size again. So you really get a sense of both the kind of the epic grandeur scape of the wall with these huge forest fires and giants and mammoths, but also a very human scale conflict where, you know, you have people like, you know, Sam and Pip, you know, who are just trying to stay alive in this swirling chaos.
Yeah. Not to get too sidetracked when we're talking about camera work, but rewatching that episode yesterday just reminded me of how fantastic John Bradley is at Samwell, and how incredibly well-written he is in the show. I really wish we could give this guy an award. He's just not in the show. His character is small enough that I know he never will, and that makes me sad. But he is wonderful, heartfelt, and very naturalistic in all of his performance there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know what actually worked a little bit better this time around than the first time that I saw this episode is I thought that Sir Alistair actually is kind of more impressive. That, you know, he's a you know, for most of the show, he's a kind of a second-tier antagonist, you know, just an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, in this episode, you really see a sense of him as this, like, you know, obviously a sour, bitter asshole of a man, but still someone who's trying to do his best for an institution that he cares for, and, you know, who genuinely steps up and leads the Night Watch in its moment of crisis. You know, and you can see that sort of frustration when he's getting pulled away, you know, wounded, where he's, you know, hold the gate, and that really felt, you know, part of it was just seeing him on the big screen. And, you know, we sort of subconsciously, if we see someone in that kind of heroic, kind of posture, and, you know, with the music and the size of him, you know, you empathize with him. You want him to succeed, you know, in spite of everything.
I mean, that's one of the things that I think the show was very smart about. In the books, I don't believe that there's anything redemptive whatsoever about Sir Alistair. They cut down the number of, you know, guys who were running the Night's Watch type guys in the show, so they had to sort of condense things into him. And I thought it was such a smart move on the show to make it, in the face of all the terrible things about this man, he's abusive, he is a terrible leader, actually, he is not training the trainees, but, and I think this is revealing, he's good at hand-to-hand combat. So you see him in there seriously kicking people's asses. And you sort of have this moment, which is something I think about as someone who thinks of organizational culture and success a lot, is just because someone is good at their actual job doesn't make them a good manager. And this is such a good example of that to me. Sir Alistair is really good at beating the fuck out of the bad guys, but he is not a good as a leader.
No,
of the,
I, you know, the funny thing is, I've written a little bit about Sir Alistair, and I've sort of pointed out that, like, he's kind of a sign of institutional rot within the Night's Watch, that, you know, he's supposed to be their master of arms, right? The guy responsible for training them to combat readiness. And, you know, that's a really important role in terms of making sure that the Night's Watch is a functional military institution. And he's terrible at it. He doesn't teach them how to fight. And it's not until, like, Jon Snow comes around that someone actually tells them.
He's, like, unbelievable.
And that's, classism is exactly the point, that at one point, you know, the old bear, Gior Mormont, says that the only reason why Sir Alistair has his job is that he's a knight, and that, you know, the Mormont doesn't have that many people who are trained knights. because, you know, if the watch was a functional institution, you'd never let this guy anywhere near a teaching position. You know, he's a good fighter, but he can't teach.
Yeah, yeah, and doesn't want to. Doesn't even want to. But
go ahead.
But the show characterizes him well here, because the show gives you space to see, like, wow, this guy is like fucking Rambo. And two, I wait for the sirens of New York to pass us by. And two, the show, you see that even though he's not as good of a leader as John is, he at least, like, keeps shit together better than Flint does. And
yes, and it's a very good
very
parallel.
Clear that Alistair, and Alistair cares. Like, he clearly cares, in the show at least. You understand that he really does care.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the way that they use Janice Flint in the episode is really, really good, that, you know, you're contrasting all of these moral choices that people are making. And, you know, Jon Snow and Sam and Gren, like, make the decision to step up. Right. They, you know, not only do they do their duty, but they go beyond that, you know, that in their own ways, they, you know, are assuming leadership roles. They're, you know, challenging themselves beyond what they think is their potential. And here is Janos Slint, the one who, you know, he's actually had years of experience, you know, leading men in a sort of a quasi military organization. And he completely checks out and runs away and hides when he's needed.
Yeah, he's almost cartoonish in that, though. Like, the fact that he is so cowardly is, like, almost cartoonish. But
yeah,
doesn't
but,
mean
know,
it's necessary.
I mean, there's a certain, unreality to reality, which is, like, this is something that happens in war. People, you know, some people charge in and other people, you know, hide in their foxholes because, you know, in that moment, they just cannot process what's happening to them. And, you know, it's not even the fact that he's, like, that visibly kind of, you know, shaking in his boots. It's almost like he's disbelieving. He can't understand what's happening around him. That, you know.
Right.
You know, like, even after he sees giants, he says, giants don't exist. And, you know, I want to kind of throw in some stuff that I really, really liked. I thought the sequence with, you know, the giants and the mammoths and then dropping the barrels of oil was really kind of viscerally astonishing. And it was sort of, that's like John's first big moment where he steps up and, you know, lead and saves the day because, you know, a few minutes more of them pulling on those gates and, you know, the whole castle falls.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so many great character moments in that episode. I want to say that to me, like, the most moving thing in that episode of the whole episode is Gren holding the tunnel and how he does that. Gren in the books, they always talk about how he's not very bright, but he's actually quite brilliant in his moment. He figured out the right way, the right thing to do to make his and his brothers act as a fighting unit and to remind them of their purpose and to bring them together and, like, steal their will, you know, is to have, just to have everyone go and do the oath and chant that, like, it's a mantra. It's great leadership.
And, you know,
incredibly smart.
Yeah, and he was great throughout the episode. Like, it's his idea to fake an order from downstairs to get Janos Slint off the wall, and that puts Jon Snow in command. And then Jon Snow has to make this fateful decision that he knows he's sending Gren to his death when he tells him to hold the tunnel. But he knows it has to be done. And, you know, Gren himself makes this, you know, ultimate heroic moment. You know, a sort of, in a way, it's a very classically fantasy moment, right? You know, the good guy is fighting a giant, you know, a monster in a dungeon. Like, it's almost literally out of Dungeons and Dragons. But the difference is, like, no one's going to know about him. No one is ever going to hear about you know, his moment of heroism. And just to skip forward a little bit, that's why I loved that moment early in episode 10 where John is meeting with Mance Rayder, and Mance says, you know, my giant, you know, Mag the Mighty went into your tunnels and never came out. And, you know, John says, yeah, you know, Gren, my friend Gren stopped him. And he says, you know, Mag the Mighty was from a lineage thousands of years older than mankind. And he says, Gren came from a fishing village. And that's like a farming village. And it's just like that.
Farming
is,
village, yeah.
And it's kind of, I think it's like Martin's, like part of his kind of spirit of kind of deconstructing to get at the heart of what makes fantasy good is that it's this clash between the ultimate otherworldly and something so, you know, and someone so simple and ordinary finding greatness within themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely,
you know,
Gren, that,
Gren doesn't get the magic sword.
Yeah. Mm-mm.
You know, he doesn't get the destiny and the prophecies. He's just the guy on the spot. But in that moment, you know, that is so much more meaningful than, you know, all the hero's journey stuff that you get in Star Wars, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, no, it's all there. I want to sort of bookmark to talk about that scene from the final episode in a little while, though. But was there anything else from the battle that really stood out to you from watching it in the IMAX?
So,
I
wanted to, like, highlight one thing I liked and one thing that I that didn't quite grab me. So the Jon Snow and Ygritte scene, I wasn't really feeling it the first time. You know, I knew what happened in the books, obviously. But the first time I watched it, it didn't really hit me that, you know, emotionally. And then, you know, but this time round, I think because it's on a bigger screen, because, you know, I can, you know, you can see the emotions on the faces so much better. You know, when they're, you know, tens of feet tall. And then the thing that I thought was kind of like underutilized a bit is Ghost. He's got that moment where he kills one guy after he's let out. And it's really like, you know, fun in that moment, but you think they could have done more to sort of show the kind of impact that the direwolf's arrival had. Hello? Oh, okay. So Ilana got dropped from the call.
I'm back.
Oh, she's back. Okay.
Okay. Freaking technology.
I was standing there for like a second.
Yeah. So, I'll pretend that I actually caught that, which I didn't, because technology was...
Okay. Short version... I actually kind of got, like, emotionally invested in John and Ygritte when I didn't the previous time, but I felt that, like, Ghost's arrival was, like, underused.
Yes, and Ghost was underused, too. I guess they were saving money. I mean, that's the only thing I could think about. What's interesting to me is when I saw, I had seen the episode before, when I saw John giving Samwell the key, I didn't know what it was for or what it was about. Like, I completely forgot, and I was like, wait, what is that the key to? What does it mean? I, like, couldn't even remember. That's how little there's been of Snow, of Ghost. And then once he came out, I was like, oh. But that's how little there's been. I didn't even remember that. It completely got from my mind. One thing that the show did... I'm sorry?
Should we talk episode 10?
Talk at what?
Talk about episode 10.
Yes, I just have one final thing about this last episode, is that second to last episode. The show is so smart in having Ollie kill Ygritte, because there was literally nobody else who could get away with it. You know, the show basically could, you know what I mean? Like, anybody else who shot Ygritte would be like the most evil motherfucker in the eyes of the audience. from then on. But because it's like the little boy who's only doing what he was told to do and whose parents got eaten alive.
And she killed his father and
mother,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it's that kind of ironic vengeance thing going on.
But the show set it up perfectly. Like, it was the only solution because, you know, the show was never going to be real, like the way the book has her. Just she got shot by someone and we don't know who, and he finds her dying. Like, that was not going to happen in this. So if in the show you're going to have to see someone shoot her, it's got to be the cute kid. Like, they figured that out.
Yeah.
And also the survival of, wow, I'm forgetting his name, our large red-headed Nordic friend.
Tormund Giantsbane.
Yeah, Tormund is, he's going to, I think, be set up to be the wildling that people are going to be, like, negotiating with on the inside until they have Matt, you know, against Mance. Like, so he's going to, I think, have like a few characters folded into him.
So, this is, like, a little bit of future speculation about season 5. But I think that Tormund takes the place of the Magnar of Fenn when we get that whole plot with the Karstarks. Because he's the kind of, he's the wildling that we like. He's like the funny kind of human wildling, whereas the Fens are kind of redesigned as these creepy, bald cannibals.
Well, they're basically like orcs. I really don't like what the show did with the Fen. I don't understand why. I know that the show probably did it because they wanted to make it more distinct band of people within the wildlings, because, you know, there's like the wildling subgroups in the show, I mean, in the books. But I don't know why they have to make some of them essentially be subhuman. I don't understand
that
choice. It's cartoonish.
I didn't like that choice. I think the idea was to kind of up the stakes, you know, because, like, we'd already met the wildlings in season 2 and 3, and we kind of, you know, like, we get that level of threat, and then the Fens are there to, like, heighten the stakes. But I agree, like, I think it's problematic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also just want to mention again, like, in the books I really felt this, too. How sad! I'm really sad about the giants getting killed. They're an endangered species, so I really hope that
There's that great bit with the. I was going to say in the books. There's that great song about the last of the giants.
Read things, but also like you have one who was like, or how do you pronounce his name? Who was a giant who was like made, you know, goes across the other side of the wall with the wildlings, and who they're trying to keep him like from getting killed, basically, because he can't control himself that well. He's not super bright, but he certainly counts as a sentient being. I really hope that he makes it out in the books, because it would have made me incredibly sad for him to die. It's not fair. He doesn't understand what he's doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
well,
so,
and,
final
and,
episode.
You know, when he acts, he's actually under threat. Like,
yeah.
You know, a guy draws a sword on him and he pulls him in half. So, yeah, shall we talk about episode 10?
Yep.
So, the first thing I wanted to sort of talk about is the scene of Stannis saving the day was another one of these moments that looked really cinematic on the big screen. And I had this big disagreement with Scott Kaufman, my co-podcaster over at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, when we watched the show, that like he felt that the decision to push the rescue into the next episode was a huge mistake, that it sort of undercut all of the kind of the catharsis and the excitement that is supposed to come with this. And I said to him at the time, I said, once we move from airing week to week to people watching this on DVD, and I wasn't even thinking about watching it, you know, in one sitting in a movie theater, that's going to go away. That is going to feel a lot more immediate and sort of, a moment to cheer in retrospect. And I think I was right that, like, you know, it was only like 2 minutes after, you know, the end of the last episode. And when Stannis, you know, arrived, like, I actually cheered. You know, I started shouting, Stannis, Stannis, Stannis.
I'm really torn. I see both of your perspectives, and I don't know how I feel about that. Because it could have been a really cool reveal to, like, wait a while and then have it happen, you know? But
yeah.
It also was a good solution to the problem of what the heck is John going to do to negotiate terms with the wildlings. You know, a lot of people complain about John. Look, a lot of people who are idiots complain about John's story in book 5 and how it's all politics. And, of course, you and I,
since
we're not idiots, are like, that's the whole point. This is about statecraft. This is what's interesting. So I'm excited that the show seems like at least it's going to have some of that going on into it, even though they're going to send him off on a side mission, which we can talk about after we finish talking about this final episode. But, you know, I like when John has to think, you know,
I agree.
Act and fight.
And, you know, he very much shows a kind of that he's absorbed the lessons of his experiences, you know, by the way that
uh-huh.
he's able to kind of handle Stannis in the moment by appealing both to, you know, his sort of highborn side where, you know, he's bringing in Ned and he's bringing in honor, but he's also, you know, talking about, you know, what he's learned north of the wall, that, you know, you need to burn the bodies and that there is, you know, the reason why you don't kill Mance right now is that the enemy is not other human beings. And that's the kind of the lesson that John is going to take forward into season 5.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's the lesson he gets from Mance. I mean, Mance is wonderful.
Yeah.
Like, I have to understand the cultural forces that made it impossible for Mance to come to the Night's Watch and try to negotiate in the first place with them. Kills me because, you know, it's one of those things where, God, I wish everybody could just talk because we all want the same things, you know?
Yeah.
That's not to say that there aren't problems with resource management as soon as you have, like, thousands and thousands more people south of the wall. You know, like, settling people in the gift is a huge political problem. Blah, 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 blah. But at the end of the day, the whole point, which John eloquently makes, which is every dead wildling is a zombie that's going to fight us, should really make it so that the wildling shouldn't need to build a giant-ass fire to get to the other side of the wall.
Right. And, you know, and one of the things that we're going to hopefully sort of see in season 5 is, you know, the political difficulties about integrating the wildlings have everything to do with questions of, you know, identity, questions about trust, and questions about integration. That, you know, the question is, you know, if you bring over the wildlings as an army that's armed, that is openly saying, like, we're not going to, you know, abide by the social contract. We're not going to recognize any political entities here in the South. You know, even if they'd gotten past the wall, it would have been, you know, this sort of horrible war of, you know, resources and, you know, tribe against tribe, you know, all the way down through the rest of Westeros. But, you know, one of the things that John, you know, is going to be spending his time doing is finding ways in which you can change identity, ways in which you can build trust and create institutions that will allow for, you know, some sort of modus vivendi that isn't, you know, 100% the wildling way, but isn't 100% the way that, you know, Stannis or the Night's Watch would prefer.
And it's interesting because Stannis, of all the possible leaders, is the person who has the strongest sense of, like, this is the way things are supposed to be, these are the rules. So in some ways, he's a lot of the hardest person to be negotiating with. It's quite a challenge. You know, if you're negotiating it with King Robb, it would be a whole different bag of worms.
Yeah.
Of worms.
Speaking of compromise, let's talk about the scene with Daenerys where she's talking about, where she's meeting with the sort of, I forget his name, but the former
teacher slave.
Yeah, the ex-slave.
Yeah.
Which, you know, really kind of you know, further emphasizes in my mind this whole my theory, which is going to be published in an essay on Tower of the Hand on Monday, that, you know, the story, the historical parallel of Danny's whole story arc in Slaver's Bay is actually about the Civil War and Reconstruction and not Iraq. Because here we have an example where, like, literally right in front of us, Daenerys is essentially recreating sharecropping as, you know, this, you know, unpleasant, as this unpleasant compromise that no one really likes, but that is tied up with, you know, the human difficulties of how do you make a transition that includes, you know, the social, the political, the economic, you know, and the sort of, you know, human frailties.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing is, of course, in my 20th century eyes, I can think of lots of other solutions, but I don't expect that that would have been clear to someone in her position. It saddens me when I hear people writing in the 21st century that, like, oh, like, she, you know, that was the only way she could have handled it or whatever. And I'm like, no, there's other ways. Just I understand why they didn't occur to someone if with her worldview and lack of knowledge of, like, socialism.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you think about it, how hard would it be to say, okay, let's set up some schools for...
Yeah, for the actual children, exactly, for everyone.
Yeah, for the children of the freedmen and, like, put the former, you know, slaves to work, you know, the former slaves who were, you know, teachers and, you know, advisors to the masters, you know, put them to work doing that. That's something that would give them, you know, subsistence. It would something that would give them social meaning that wouldn't involve, you know, selling yourself back into slavery. So the speaking of sort of human frailties, you know, the another scene that kind of looked amazing on the big screen is when Dany makes the decision to chain up her dragon.
Oh, my heart. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just, it really was heartbreaking because, you know, those, the, her, Viserion and Rhaegal are, you know, screaming like, you know, abandoned children.
Yeah. They realize what's happening. Like, they realize at the very last minute, they realize what's happening to them. I have to tell you, when I came home last night, Frank had been, my husband had been brushing our cat, and his, like, the cat's collar was off, and I was like, oh, I better put on his collar before I go to bed. And my heart broke a little bit putting his collar back on, just thinking about the dragons, because it's done so well, and it's so sad. And she has no other choice. Like, she has no other choice.
Right.
Even in a world where she had actual training on how to run dragons, she wouldn't be at a position at this point where she would know how to manage them, so they weren't eating children.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that we're going to see from Dany in the next season, and we got a lot of this in the trailer, which we're going to be talking about shortly, is, you know, this decision is going to have huge ramifications. That, you know, this is something that she's doing for what on the face of it is an incredibly kind of moral decision, you know, a very human decision, you know, is going to have unintended consequences that she really has not considered.
Yeah. Do you want to mention any of them? Or?
Well, I do when we talk about the trailer. You know, just to keep this ball rolling, I mean, you know, if we want to talk about one of the things that, that still doesn't work, didn't work at the time, still doesn't work, is the interactions between Jaime and Cersei and Cersei and Tywin. I felt fell flat completely. And, you know, are signs that the show did some real damage to itself with the now infamous scene in, I think it was episode 3 of season 4, the scene between Jaime and Cersei in the Sept of Baelor.
Because
like
the horrible
really
rape
kind
scene
of deranged their relationship.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I forget who wrote it, and I apologize because that person is really smart. I think we basically have to watch the show pretending that that scene never happened, or else the show makes
yeah.
it.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So
is that,
retcon,
you know,
it. Retcon it. That rape didn't happen. The show only makes sense if it didn't happen. The show doesn't seem to happen anyway, apparently. So let's pretend it never happened.
Yeah, I have this idea in mind of a fan edit project of Game of Thrones. And, like, you know, on my list of notes, I say, like, you know, immediately after they kiss, that scene ends. You know, cut that there, because it's the only way to sort of salvage anything from the wreckage. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, everything with Tyrion and Tywin was so well done and so brilliantly acted and, you know, heart-wrenching. And it's just like, you know, I'm beyond irritated that Game of Thrones cannot get, you know, Golden Globes and Emmy nominations in the way that it really deserves, because that, for my money, is some of the best acting on television.
Yeah. They were tremendous there. And it was all the conversation between Tyrion and Tywin is perfect. And, like, you can see the thought processes in Tyrion's mind changing as it happens. And you have to, you wonder, like, if Tywin hadn't dismissed Shay as just being a whore and whores being something that's less than human, would Tyrion have done what he did?
That's a very good question.
But Tywin has to be a classist sexist fuckhead till the end. So, you know, there you go. You're going to act like that and people are going to hate you. Sorry.
Yeah. It really is kind of a cross between, like, the House of Atreus and, you know, some, like, classical Freudian drama. It's just like the House of Lannister is just so fucked up on a psychosexual level.
Oh, my God. Just for folks, when we were at the IMAX showing, you'd have audiences cheering at different moments. It was interesting to me when that happened. And as we came upon the Shay scene in episode 10, I started to get incredibly scared. Because
if someone in the audience,
because there was totally some bro shit going on in there, I was scared. If people cheer when he strangles her, I will find them in the theater and I will clock them. And much to my relief, there was like a little bit of uncomfortable sound that I can't quite describe that was produced, but there was no cheering. There was no clapping. So we've survived the test of the bad fans.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that was good.
There was one dickbag who said, like, when Ollie shot Ygritte, who I overheard saying, like, bros before hoes, and I was like...
Yeah, I heard that,
but
too.
But if they had said that about Shay, like, Tyrion killing Shay is, like, a terrible tragedy, and it's, you know, and it's, like, not something to cheer. It's terrible. And incredibly well acted, of course. And, I was relieved that did not get the idiot reaction I was beginning to figure it might receive.
Yeah. So the next thing to sort of talk about is the sequence with Bran and company at the tree. And, you know, I feel very ambivalent about it because on the one hand, especially on the big screen, when you see that tree, you know, backlit by this golden sunshine, and then you see the battle sequence with the Ray Harryhausen skeletons, and, you know, Hodoring and the wolf, you know, tearing shit up. That stuff's amazing, and it's really visceral and awesome. And then you see the three-eyed raven, and it's just a dude in a tree chair who has two eyes. And it's
two,
like,
eyes,
oh,
for no reason.
Man.
And he doesn't have a mark on his face that looks like a raven.
Yeah, and he's not
the
albino.
No blood raven.
And it's, you know, and I'm really hoping, I'm really, really, really hoping that when Bran comes back to the show, and FYI for people who don't know, he's not in season 5, that in season 6 they're going to have more money and do a better job with the makeup because it looked like shit.
It really but it isn't even a money question. I know people who could have done better stage makeup using practical effects to make that man look interesting. They could have freaking done it with practical effects. Screw CGI.
Okay. Fire the makeup person, hire a better one. I don't know.
Thank you.
Whatever you need to do
to
make that work.
You know. But so you mentioned the Ray Harryhausen skeleton fighting in that scene. People complained about that a lot and complained about it as looking like bad CGI. Watching it yesterday, huge. I don't think I could pinpoint, like, well, what was bad about the CGI? Like, what made it not work? I think either you have a pre-decided that you don't like skeletons that are costumed in that way because they remind you of claymation movies, or you're just like, yeah, whatever, I'll roll with this. It's not a great fight scene. It's not blah, blah, but it's not terrible. Like, I don't know why people were so... I mean, the real problem, right, is Three-Eyed Crow and how completely undramatic and lack of creative that is.
I think it was kind of the unexpected nature of it and the sort of lack of setup. So, you know, I was thinking to myself, you know, if those skeletons had been zombies, right? Because we've seen, you know, we've had at this point, what, one, two, arguably three seasons worth of zombies. I think people would have accepted that.
Yeah, it would have made more sense.
Whereas, you know, I kind of like the skeletons. I mean, just, you know, because I'm a big fan of the Ray Harryhausen stuff. And, you know, I love the shot of them exploding when they pass the entry of the cave. But I can see that if you weren't prepped for that, that would come off really sort of somehow out of place.
Well, you know what felt out of place, too, is the people of the forest. Her voice sounded like she was acting. It didn't sound, and I didn't like the way they were styled. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to know what to do with children of the forest so that they work in this format. But I don't like the creation. And I don't like the acting.
It was a little bit awkward. You know, it was like
it felt like she was reading a script saying, come if you want to live. It was like what I would have done. And I'm not a freaking actor, so.
Yeah, you know how like, child actors can be such a difficult balancing game? Like, you're never sure if you're going to get a good actor down the line. I mean, HBO has been really, really lucky in that they got, you know, child actors, you know, 4 years ago who are turning into brilliant talents. And, you know, we'll talk about that when we get to the Arya sequence. But, you know, I felt like this time around they got a dud. They got a kid who could read off a script but who couldn't really project what needs to be an otherworldly, strange presence.
It was not. And you don't want them to look too much like frauds, you know, fairies, which would have been one passable bad way to go. Looking in the World of Ice and Fire book, I mean, I wasn't crazy about how they were depicted in that, but that just—I don't know. I don't think that the people in—I don't think the creative team on any of these platforms really knows what to do with the Children of the Forest.
I agree, and luckily they're not going to be an issue next season, so they'll have some time to get their heads around it,
figure it out.
One thing that I absolutely loved, and which looked amazing on the big screen, is the sequence where Arya and Brienne finally meet, and then Brienne and the Hound have this huge knockdown, drag-out fight. That was viscerally astonishing. I was tense, that whole fight. I mean, especially, you know, towards the end where she's losing it and just beating him in the face with a rock. You know, that, like, genuinely frightened me.
I have to say that scene, I was, you know, incredibly well acted and all that, but the whole time I'm just thinking, neither of you has a plan. You should not be fighting. Nobody, like, neither of them has any fucking plan of what to do. And there they are fighting to the death for no fucking reason.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you know, partially that gets to sort of the inherent tragedy of both of these people. That, you know, in many ways, Brienne and the Hound are similar kinds of people. They're people who are kind of outside of knighthood, but who sort of secretly kind of wish they could be inside. You know, for all that the Hound, you know, says he's not a knight, he started out as someone who desperately wanted to be a knight and, you know, goes down, you know, seemingly to his death in what he thinks is defense of a child, you know, fulfilling the knight's oath. But, you know, because of their the lives that they've led.
He doesn't actually think that. When he's standing there being dying, he tells Arya to go find Brienne.
Yes. Well, I mean, but I think that's, like, him following through is that, like, his attitude is, like, I'm going to defend Arya from her, but, you know, at the end of the day, he wants Arya to live, and he thinks that Arya's going to die if she's on her own.
Well, if he didn't think, it all seems like it's for nothing. I mean, really for nothing.
Yeah. On the other hand, I will say, compare this to the books, where, you know, Brienne spends an entire book wandering around the Riverlands, never getting anywhere close to either Arya or Sansa. The fact that, you know, this time she is at least able to set eyes on her and has that kind of, you know, even if it's an ephemeral, even if it, you know, ultimately is a failure, that brief moment of success,
mm-hmm.
you know, felt great.
And the fact that Arya got to see Brienne is important.
Yes, and it's hopefully, I mean, and we're about to start discussing this next season, but, like, hopefully could have real implications for her storyline in season 5,
mm.
which I have no idea which way they're going on it.
Yeah, I mean, I just really feel like, psychologically speaking, for Arya's sense of self, I think it was important for her to see, like, a grown woman who is doing what Arya feels like she would want to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a really, like, good thing for Arya. Even if Arya thinks that she's, like, a Lannister, you know, and evil, like, Arya mm-hmm. at least sees a grown-up version of what she might be able to be. So...
Mm-hmm. So should we pivot to talking about the trailer?
Yeah, let's talk about the trailer. I feel like a jerk because I still haven't figured out why, but I'm really frustrated by the use of the song Heroes in the trailer. It's not the, you know, standard Bowie recording of it. It's sound is shifted. It's like a sound shifted version of it. I feel the best I can guess is that the song actually has nothing at all to do with the show in any way, shape, or form, and yet it's also not operating on a level of irony. So it feels to me like it was put together by someone who does not either understand the show or the song. And since I deeply, passionately love David Bowie, and I'm a huge fan of A Song of Ice and Fire, the thought of somebody who doesn't understand these things attempting to combine them makes me angry.
Fair enough. I mean, I am not as familiar with the discography of David Bowie. So I just wanted to sort of walk people through what they might have seen, because and this is fairly common for the trailers for this show. There's a lot of very, very brief moments, like, you know, sometimes less than a second, that are potentially really important and consequential for, like, telling us what's going to happen in the season.
Uh-huh.
So, it, you know, in terms of the visuals of the show that we see, right, the first shot is Jaime standing vigil over Tywin's body as Cersei is leaving. So, you know, we very much sort of get a sense that, like, part of this storyline is the immediate aftermath of, you know, Jaime's decision to free Tyrion. And the fact that there's a phrase like, what is it, like, the worst thing in the... Hold on. Let me actually play the trailer for, like, just a second
yeah.
so I can hear that line.
Literally the first thing, sure.
Okay. So the line is, nothing is more hateful than failing to protect the one you love. And I think that kind of nicely sets up, like, where, you know, obviously a huge conflict between Jaime and Cersei is going to be, you know, this conflict over the fact that at the end of the day, he is, you know, responsible for freeing Tyrion. He is responsible for... you know, Tywin's death. And I think, you know, the Dorne sequence that Jaime's about to go through has a lot to do with Jaime trying to make up for what he did and Cersei sort of putting it on his shoulders that he has to sort of make up for his actions.
Oh, I have thoughts about that, but continue, sorry.
Well, no, that's all I had to say on that particular storyline.
Oh, yeah, so I am just realizing now because of you talking that she's going to send Jaime to go rescue
Myrcella.
And that explains all the Dorne stuff, which incidentally I couldn't, watching the trailer, it wasn't until I was reading this Reddit cheat sheet, I couldn't identify the Jaime in Dorne stuff.
Yeah, so he's definitely going to Dorne. One of the shots that I just want to sort of explain to people, because it's not very visually clear, there is a shot where that collapsing thing opens up on the table in front of Cersei. That is a viper, a dead viper, holding Myrcella's necklace in its mouth. And it's been sent to the small council from Dorne. And that's what's going to kind of prompt Cersei to send Jaime to Dorne. So we're definitely getting a sense of that Dorne is definitely, it's changing, but it's also getting beefed up. We see a lot of shots of the sand snakes. We definitely get a sense that they are very different people. They dress differently. You know, you get a sequence where, like, Obara is fighting with a whip, and she's at one point, like, very, very, very briefly fighting Jaime. But you also get a shot of Ilaria Sand wearing very revealing clothing and obviously, you know, trying to seduce Jaime in some way. So I'm under the feeling that Ilaria Sand is essentially going to replace Arianne in the Dorne story.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that...
And that he'll replace Aerys Oakenheart. Yeah.
Yes. Although I think he'll probably survive. Yes. I will say, though, that, you know, regardless of, like, how, you know, how divergent they're being from the books, the Dorne sequences look visually absolutely stunning. And I think they're just going to be fun to watch just as, you know, on the level of sheer, aesthetic pleasure.
Yeah.
So the next sort of sequence that I want to talk about is John going to Hardhome, which we get a lot of shots of, and it seems like this is going to be the kind of one of the big moments for Jon Snow that, you know, in A Dance with Dragons, he sends Cotter Pike to try to rescue a whole bunch of wildlings who have been trapped at Hardhome to prevent them from being turned into zombies. And here we get these, you know, really interesting shots of, you know, wildlings in this, you know, village right by the sea. We see wildlings rushing onto boats. We see, you know, Jon Snow leading wildlings, you know, and these, like, ominous presences outside these wooden palisade walls. So that's definitely going to be a big part of his plot.
Yeah, I think that they're not going to have him be Lord Commander, you know, anytime soon, interestingly. They'll make him, like, be the number...
I'm going to take a bet and say I think he becomes Lord Commander by the end of episode 2.
Really?
Yeah.
And the Lord Commander is the one who goes up to Hardhome?
Yes.
Who does he leave in charge then?
I mean, my guess is Dolorous Ed. I think he makes it back from Hardhome before the end of the season, though. So another thing that seems to be really important to Jon's storyline is Melisandre, who is sort of shown setting fire to pyres and at 1 minute 38 seems to be getting naked in the chambers of the Lord Commander.
Yeah.
So that's going to be interesting to see what they do with that.
Yeah, that's another reason why I think he's not going to be the Lord Commander. I think he's going to be Lord Commander later. I feel like he's doing some like special mission or whatever.
All right. Well, you know, we'll bet a Donner kebab on it. So the other thing that was sort of a big theme throughout the trailer is the Vale is and Sansa is definitely going to be a big part of the season.
Yeah,
that we get the sense, you know, they're really starting to play up the Vale as a military force. We get all of these shots of the Knights of the Vale riding around on horseback. And then we get two lines, you know, there aren't a whole lot of lines of dialogue in the trailer, but two of them are Peter tells Sansa, there is no justice in this world unless we make it and avenge them. So, you know, and this is something where, like, as book readers, we are genuinely in the dark. Like, this is beyond, this is the Winds of Winter territory. We do not know what's going to happen here.
Yeah, I think that there's a question of, I mean, I think we know who he wants her to, you know, he's talking about revenge for family, but not clear how.
Right, but, you know, what that entails and, you know, whether Sansa, whether that's going to be an ironic line with Sansa avenging herself on Littlefinger, who more than anyone else is primarily responsible for the downfall of her house.
Yeah, which I think she understands or will come to.
Yeah, so, you know, that's going to be very interesting to see. And, you know, God only knows what this controversial, traumatic scene that, you know, they've told us about is. I think we're just going to have to wait and see.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I mean, I feel like the last scene that we had of Sansa in season four, you know, you have this moment where she's clearly crafting herself into this new identity.
Right.
And she is not just being the victim of her fate. So I feel like she's at a place where she's you know, she knows what's what with
Littlefinger.
Yeah, but she's going to be playing along. I mean, the fact that she's in a room being guarded is an interesting point.
Yeah, guarded, I don't know what's up with that.
Guarded from who? From Littlefinger? Guarded by Littlefinger from someone else?
So I wanted to talk about the others, another kind of big thing that we saw, the Dany and the Sons of the Harpy, is clearly the big moment, the big part of her plot. And you know, it's really interesting that they've shifted from the books. In the books, it's Dany's supporters who wear the masks, and here it's the Sons of the Harpy who are wearing these very spooky looking gold masks. And we can see them, you know, attacking people in the street. We see their masks. We see at one point they're menacing Daenerys in the arena. And we see Dany saying, you know, I'm not going to stop the wheel. I'm going to break the wheel. I don't know exactly what that's referring to. And then we have this amazing shot of the harpy being toppled from the pyramid and come crashing down. By the way, I think this is further proof of my argument, which all of you can read on Monday at Tower of the Hand, that the Sons of the Harpy are the clan. They are meant to be a parallel to, you know, a white supremacist terrorist organization.
Yeah, I think that's clear. Especially with the hoods and masks and all that. You seem to really like the costumes that they came up with for the Brazen Beast.
Well, turns out that's not the Brazen Beast. That's the Sons of the Harpy.
Oh, I thought that there were other people who had horns. I thought I saw someone with gold mask with horns on.
No, the horns are like built into the top of the head because the harpy has horns.
Oh, so it's the same people. It's the same people. Okay.
Yeah, it's the same people. And you know, there's something really eerie about. You know, I don't know what it is. It's some sort of uncanny valley thing that whenever you see a lot of people wearing masks that are human-shaped but aren't moving and aren't reacting, that there's something really creepy about that. You know, it's the same reason why, like, or not the same reason, but it's part of the reason why, like, a lot of the, you know, classic Doctor Who villains, like the Weeping Angels or the Cybermen, are kind of spooky. That, like, there's human there's faces, but they're not moving, and there's a lot of them.
Right.
They all look the same. So a couple things that I wanted to sort of shortly go over. One is that the finger dripping blood and the two young girls walking in the forest, I think that's Cersei's flashback to the prophecy of Maggie the Frog.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's interesting that this is what the show, when I first heard that they were casting young Cersei, I was like, the show had this rule before that they were not going to do any flashbacks. And, of course, you can always break rules. But I was surprised that this was what they were going to be breaking it for. And the thing I can think about is that, so they're not including any of the flashbacks that are actually in the book, but they're including a flashback that's not in the book. And then what's this? I mean, this is a flashback that's in the book, but not in any kind of mystical context. It's just her thinking in her mind. I'm wondering if the choice to do this one is that, well, I don't freaking know. I don't know if it's because it's impossible to truly illustrate any other way, or if it's going to be a symptom of Cersei losing her mind that she'll be seeing it. Why do you think this is the thing?
Yeah, if I had to guess, I think it's because, you know, now that Tywin is dead, Cersei is really carrying the King's Landing plot on her shoulder. Like, Tywin's dead, Tyrion's gone. You know, she's really the kind of one of the only important adults in that storyline. So I think the idea of having a flashback is to begin to get us into the head of Cersei Lannister in a way that they haven't really done before, and give her the kind of the weight and complexity of a major character.
Yeah. Okay. I'll buy that.
That. So the next thing I want to talk about is Tyrion and Varys. So, you know, this is, I think, some of the kind of most controversial stuff from book purists' perspective, that it is very clear that Varys and Tyrion are sort of more straightforwardly going to support Dany, which suggests that the whole bit with, you know, Aegon Targaryen? Maybe, you know,
we'll
is probably
Fagon. Fagon of sources unknown.
Yeah, is probably
definitely Fagon, but who he is actually is not, like, I'm not swearing on it, so I just call him Fagon in general.
Yeah, so, you know, the show has clearly decided to just streamline it and have Tyrion go straight to Dany. Now, one thing that I did want to sort of let people know that might suggest things are a little bit more complicated than some people are thinking is that we have reports, I mean, we know from casting that Tyrion is going to be sold as a slave. And that he's going to meet Jorah in Volantis. So what we may, and then wind up with Daenerys. What we may have happen is that, like, Tyrion and Varys go to Volantis, and then Tyrion gets suddenly hijacked at Volantis and winds up in Meereen, and that leaves Varys kind of, at potential loose ends. And I have seen some people saying there's a very quick shot where you see the Sand Snakes, Obara whips off a bucket that's on someone's head, and you see from the back a bald head buried up to his a bald-headed man up to his neck in the sand. That could well be Varys.
And it's a larger man, isn't it?
Yes, it could be Varys. I mean, I'm not 100% on that, but it could be that he winds up in Dorne at the end of the season, which that would be very interesting.
You know who else ends up in Dorne? Aegon.
Yeah, exactly. So the other big thing that we see a lot of, is, Arya, and, you know, we see her at the House of Black and White, we see her changing, you know, she's changed her clothes, and she's pondering Needle and deciding what to do with the sword. Clearly, Arya's storyline is going to be a really big part of season five, and it's something that I'm personally looking forward to. You know, we're going to be spending quite a bit of time in Braavos in season five, and I really cannot wait.
Yeah, Braavos is awesome. It's a really rich and interesting setting. It's much more cosmopolitan. It's like they're having the Renaissance over there while the rest of the world is stuck in the Middle Ages. But I do want to go back to the whole, like, Tyrion, Varys thing. I really enjoy the plot and the story around can you create the perfect prince? And I'm not surprised to be losing that in the show, but I'm sad to be losing it. I don't care because I'm a purist. I am not a purist. Like, there's things that the show did. Like, the show's invention of Shay being awesome is awesome. Roz, great invention. You need to have somebody lowborn to identify with, like, to bring them into the world of people that matter as a viewer. I mean, there's lots of things the show did that it invented itself that are great. But I really feel like you're losing some of the big political questions that the book poses when you get rid of that story. That said, I mean, it's hard to imagine how you'd compress it.
I agree. I understand why they want to move Tyrion and Daenerys to meeting because, I mean, honestly, and this is where, like, I get into some disagreements, you know, with my fellow book readers, is I remember when A Dance with Dragons came out, people hated the Tyrion storyline. They were pissed that he spent the whole book moping and never got to meet Daenerys. And I was like, everyone was really irritated. So the show is actually doing something smart. They're just going straight from A to B and, you know, giving us the emotional payoffs that we're looking for. Now, I think it sucks that we're losing Aegon. I'm a little bit more worried that we don't seem to have any Ironborn plot. That's kind of something that's politically huge.
One of my friends actually said that he thought he saw Yara, and I went to go watch it again, and I'm like, I don't see Yara at all.
Yeah, I don't see her either. You know, now, it's possible, you know, this is, you know, an open question, that they're going to do that for season six, right? That, you know, part of what they're, you know, part of what they're dealing with here is that they're moving through material so fast that they, you know, they have to sort of pick and choose. Now, we know, we see Theon. So clearly that part of the plot is not going away. So I think it's one of those things where as much as possible, they are going to only bring in things when they absolutely have to. And, you know, I'm still very confused about that. Like, I don't quite get how they're going to have the whole conflict between Cersei and Margaery without the sort of the impact of the Ironborn attacking the Reach, you know, driving that conflict. You know, but, you know, we'll see how they go. Now, you know, notably, other things that we didn't really see. We didn't really see Stannis or Davos, although I think that shot of the map with the chess pieces on it is probably Stannis's.
Yeah.
We didn't really
of Bolton's.
Yeah. We didn't really see Brienne or Podrick Payne.
No, not even for a moment.
Yeah, so, you know, there's still a lot that's up in the air. Still a lot that we don't know what they're going to do. I mean, because we know that they're going to have Stannis. Like, I'm looking at advanced photos that HBO just released, and it's like, yeah, Stannis is there. And, you know, and I can see, you know, other photos of Roose Bolton and Ramsay Bolton and Fat Walda, like, in the courtyard of Winterfell. So clearly that plot is still going on. You know, I can see style, you know, shots of Tormund, in, and other wildlings in Castle Black. That's still going on. So, you know, oh, likewise, the High Sparrow and the whole Sparrow movement. We know that's a plot this season, but we didn't get to see that. So I think there's a lot that's up in the air.
Yeah. I think that those are very unclear. I'm thumbing through the pictures right now, actually. Oh, the lighting is so good.
Yeah, the when they do it, like when they release the official stuff as opposed to whatever people, you know, scooped up on their own with cameras, it really is just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, so many of them look like paintings.
Yeah, in fact, there's someone on Tumblr, I'm blanking on the name, but it may be Nobody Suspects the Butterfly, did this whole analysis of Sansa on the show and allusions to classic paintings. And it's really quite amazing.
There's definitely one that's a pre-Raphaelite painting. That was the scene of her in the garden before
there's
she
There's that one.
Yeah.
There's the bit where she's wearing the hood on her escape from King's Landing that looks almost exactly like a girl with the pearl earring.
Pearl earring, yeah.
You know, so there's all kinds of like little artistic moments like that.
Yeah, definitely. Marjorie is always though like lit like she's in a painting. There's that scene where she goes to feed the poor children in season whatever season she first arrives in King's Landing in. And that looks like looks like a painting too, but it doesn't look like a Renaissance painting to me. It looks like John Stringer Sargent's paintings of the Moors, interestingly. But yeah, there's a lot of amazing, beautiful lighting. Oh, before I forget, while I'm talking about aesthetic things, so we were talking about Kai and Sam, perhaps trying to seduce Jamie Lannister in Dorne, and as her potentially being the woman in the cutoff vest. The fabric that vest is made out of is totally the same as the fabric of one of one of the dresses that Margaery wears all the time. So I kept associating them and thinking, I didn't even get that that was a woman from Dorne because of the fabric. Like, it's the same freaking bowls of fabric. But I'm sure that it's from, I'm sure that you're right. Like, it makes sense to me that that would be, you know, a scene in Dorne, since, like, the costume is sort of Dornish-ish. But it's just, I don't know, it's just weird. I don't know why you would use, for one thing, that particular blue-gray-green is so, so associated with Margaery. That's like for color shows.
You know, if you look at that photo of Margaery in this season, she's wearing different colors.
She's wearing gold.
She's now trying to... Yeah, and all of her girls are now dressed in gold. Right, she started off wearing a sort of Tyrell blue-green, and now she is very much wearing Baratheon gold.
Gold, yep. And
so,
Lannister, you know, gold being the one color that Baratheons and Lannisters share, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's definitely a noted departure from her usual color scheme, but I just don't know why they put that on one of the Sand Snakes. Kind of weird. It's confusing enough that the woman looks white for me to not be confused about who she is, but they're going to put her in Margaery colors. Yep.
So that's all I got.
Yeah, I think that's about it for me. I'm curious to see what's coming next, and I'm really excited, as I know you are, to have Alexander Siddig as Doran Martell, and how that's going to be freaking awesome. And
agreed.
Yeah.
Okay,
in the end of the day,
would you
in the end of the day, would you recommend people to check out the stuff in IMAX if it comes to their town?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it, you know, it really is a very different visual experience from watching it at home. And you know, I will not be surprised if HBO decides to basically do IMAX showings of Game of Thrones in future years.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it. Well, thank you again.
Cool.
I'm really excited to be able to do this, and thanks for having me join you. So if folks want to see more, So folks, if you're interested in hearing more from Graphic Policy Radio, I realize that some of you are probably only listening to this because you know that Stephen is awesome and you're a big Game of Thrones person. Graphic Policy Radio is a podcast where we talk about superhero comics and independent comics and all kinds of comics, but a little bit heavy on the superheroes, through the perspective of two left-wing type individuals who've worked in politics. So if you're interested in smart, I hope, analysis of comics and conversations around the industry as well as the art and writing, then I hope you'll tune into our podcast. Thanks again, Stephen.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye.